For February 3rd, 2016, this is episode 37 of the PHP Roundtable. Today's topic of discussion is all about Object Relational Mappers, or ORMs. I'm your host, Sammy K. Powers.
Right now, I'm in a Starbucks, and it's windy outside, and I've had a lot of internet trouble and microphone trouble. So hopefully, I'm gonna be the one with the worst audio quality here on the show, but hopefully, I can do some post editing and make it a little clearer. So, object relational mappers—that's a mouthful to say. So we're just gonna say ORM. ORMs are tools that help us deal with the problem of interacting with relational databases from our object-oriented code bases. There are a number of ORM libraries in PHP, like Propel, Doctrine, and Spot ORM, and many web frameworks that come with their own flavor of an ORM, like Eloquent and Laravel, for example. Each of these ORM libraries have different approaches to tackling the elusive problem of representing our relational data in an OOP world. Today we're having a discussion that's all about ORMs from the perspective of the PHP community. And our panel consists of some pretty cool ORM nerds. So without further ado, we have with us the Ross Tuck, who has the most interesting one-liner intros in the world every time he joins the PHP Roundtable. And his one-liner intro for today is Incompetent Pat. Welcome, Ross.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. And we also have Sean McCool, who's a software developer, conference organizer, and game design aficionado. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, Sammy. Thanks a lot for having me here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, man. And finally, we have Marco Privetta, also known as Oprimus on Twitter. He's the release manager for Doctrine 2 ORM and Zen Framework Maintainer. Welcome, Marco.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello, hello. So there's been a lot of buzz on Twitter kind of leading up to this one, not only because PHP Roundtable has been on a bit of a hiatus after the holidays, but also because when we kind of threw out there that we're having an ORM discussion, a lot of people were automatically kind of tackling onto that active record versus data mapper kind of debating thing that might happen. And in fact, Jeffrey Way on Twitter was saying, can't wait to hear Doctrine users and developers talk about how Active Record is great for their small projects, smiley face. So, it's going to be fun, but we'll talk about that towards the end. But before we get to the more controversial aspects of ORMs, let's just kind of have a general discussion about ORMs themselves. And I just want to kick this off to anybody anybody at the roundtable here that if you're sitting next to a developer who has never used an ORM in her project before, what would be your elevator pitch to her?
We're assuming that they are doing all their object-oriented code and the mapping between their data and that object manually at this point.
Or maybe just somebody who is used to just hitting, making raw SQL queries to the database, maybe not even escaping them properly, maybe just kind of directly interfacing with the now defunct MySQL extension in PHP.
Can we just point out really quick that this is fundamentally an object-oriented tool, right? So the very idea is that you have objects and the data has to map to some kind of data source that doesn't fundamentally match the object model, right? So it's a mapping. It's a necessary mapping. And when we say relational, we're not talking about relationships as in one-to-many, many-to-many. We're actually talking about relation as in a database table. So when relational databases are referred to, they're talking about tables of discrete types with the data filling in its rows. So Marco, you want to go ahead and kind of take it from here?
Yeah, well, what would we say to something like that? I'm not really sure how I would pitch it to a user like that, because it's, to be honest, it's really rare to find users that don't have any kind of experience with this sort of mapping approach. So as we said, it's about taking the relational data that is at the database layer and transforming it into something that is more meaningful at application level. What I would show to a user is how they can actually take the object-oriented concepts that they know about that may be good or bad depending on whether you like it or not, and see how they can actually encapsulate their logic inside this object level diagram of objects, entities, however you call them, and how this can be saved on the database and how this makes it simpler. On the other side, it's a major step forward in complexity. You have much more configuration, so it's really hard to convince such people. And some of them are really, really skeptic. After all, you're introducing a very complicated tool. So it's, I wouldn't say that it's like something that you need to pitch. To be honest, I stopped doing this thing where I pitch it. It's harmful. You're just pushing a tool for the sake of pushing a tool. I think there must be a good use case for it first. There are some cases where the old style, fetching a row, iterating, doing whatever you need to do, and then printing some output, whatever, that is perfectly okay. If they have a strong use case, then this need for an ORM emerges on itself, in my opinion. Ross, you want to take on?
Sure. My elevator pitch would be leave the boring parts to somebody else. I've worked on a lot of code bases where people are still using just raw direct queries. And what you see 99% of the time is just like long, long rows of easy to automate, really, really simple SQL queries, which are just kind of drowning the rest of the application. Database access, if you're dealing with it, is like really, really noisy. And you can try and automate that with some quick helper functions and stuff, but you're going to drown in that really, really quick. And I would argue that any good ORM library, no matter what paradigm it's using, is going to help you encapsulate that, not just for testing and better OOP practices and so on, but also, frankly, just to make your life a little bit more sane. And to come back to the non-elevator pitch parts of what we've been talking about, I think that this is that the scope of ORM is broader than many people like to make it. For example, as you say, it's object relational mapping, and you can argue about whether or not Active Record is ORM, but I would consider it ORM. It's mapping from an object to a database and vice versa. Maybe it's not a very rich or very different implementation, but it's ORM, and the goals are essentially the same: to reach into a database, pull some data out, do something with it. Perhaps the methodology and the focus differs a little bit, but it's still within the scope of ORM. The rest is just the pattern the ORM implements. Beyond that, and I won't like have any firm opinion on this, but I'm interested in what Sean said, in that it's an, fundamentally an object-oriented approach, because I know you're really interested in functional programming a lot these days. And it strikes me that while functional programming doesn't have objects, it does have structs, it does have rich data types, which you may want to map back and forth to a database. And how rich those structures are, for example, may have elements of, well, not ORM, but some kind of something to RM.
It's still mapping.
It's still mapping. It's still mapping something. But I'm curious about, like, is there like a fundamentally different paradigm that we can approach that stuff with? But I guess we can talk about that a bit later, perhaps.
So would you say that somebody who has never doesn't have a strong object-oriented sort of background, that jumping into an ORM might be a little bit crazy of a learning curve for them to get associated with it, right?
Yeah, it will be.
Maybe you just jump into it anyway. I mean, why not, right? Jump headfirst into icy water and just swim, I guess. Learn how to swim.
Exactly. And also, like, I think the level of complexity differs from tool to tool. If you count, like, you know, very simple mapping tools, then the complexity is not very deep. And also, complexity is relative, right? I mean, a good abstraction takes away underlying complexity and gives you a simpler interface on top. So while you might have to learn some of what that tool does, when it comes to the day-to-day tasks, you can forget it. There's a lot less to remember in each given moment if the tool is doing its job and if it's being used appropriately. So I think, like, we can say simple, but it's kind of like the opposite of what I think it was Arthur C. Clarke always says, that magic is just technology we don't understand yet, but simple is just problems I've left to someone else. You know?
That simple versus complex thing, that we've talked about that in the past, and it's kind of interesting when it comes to programming and things like that. But if somebody had never kind of experienced ORMs before, or maybe just dabbled in it, and they go on Google and they Google, like, what's ORMs all about? I found the Stack Overflow thread that was answering the kind of that question. And I have a couple things to throw at you guys. One of the things that the thread said is that one of the pros of an ORM is sanitization, and that, you know, like, using prepared statements is easy. Like, it's just like sending your values to a method, and it automatically escapes all your values. But, you know, we have that with PHP data objects or the PDO extension and PD, because that has prepared statements and will escape your data. Also, it says it abstracts all of your code from the database system itself, like from those actual functions in PHP that are interacting with your database, like literally the ones called MySQL or whatever. And so it's a DBAL, it's a database abstraction layer. But there are DBALs out there, database abstraction layers, that aren't ORMs. So what are some more pros that aren't necessarily these other things that we can get from either PDO or DBAL that make ORM awesome sauce?
Well, clearly the abstraction of the persistence system of the database system is, it comes with ORMs like almost always, right? So you can, Doctrine has its stuff, and you know, Laravel's Eloquent is built on Laravel's Query Builder, which is, you know, another abstraction layer. I wouldn't bundle those fundamentally in with the value of the ORM, right? To me, the value of the ORM is more not having to do that mapping. So what happens if you write an object model that does what you want it to do? How are you going to get the data out of that and store it long term? This is really the fundamental question. So do we write our own custom code that pulls those objects apart and then maps them to database fields? What happens when we have objects that are part of that object? How then do those map to database fields? So to me, the ORM is all about creating a solution for that mapping. And sure, the database abstraction stuff, it tends to come with it, right? But maybe that's not a specific value of the ORM itself.
That is indeed the value of the ORM. You are now completely moving out the problem of dealing with how the data is structured inside the persistence layer. What I found interesting about the security thing, and this comes directly from what I saw at the conference you were organizing, the DDT Europe, the other day, is that since the ORM is now completely abstracting away the problem of saving and loading data, the entire context of saving and loading data, so everything that is in the knowledge about saving and loading data, is dealt by this tool, or however you want to call it. And this means that when you translate your data into your objects that then you want to save, this translation between objects to whatever you use for the saving and loading at is dealt with by this tool. And this means that the translation is done correctly. The translation of value to database field is exactly where all the SQL injections happen, for example, where everything like XSS, SQL injection, parameter injection, whatever, everything happens there. So if we do the translation correctly, which is now the work of the tool, then you don't have the security issue up front. So there is an advantage there, but it's indeed about, it's just a side effect of the great advantage of the tool there, which is also one of the disadvantages though. So we'll talk about that later. Ross, you want to take on?
But I think like that's a really good example of like an ORM actually lets you forget things. People latch onto the complexity really, really hard. But in fact, it's less complex. I'm not thinking about the escaping. It's built into the interface of what I'm working with. And then there's another kind of translation I think that's really important with an ORM, which is like the interface that you want to consume in the rest of your code. Like we're really used to looking at the tooling and saying like, library A does it this way, library B does it that way. But very few times do we actually stop, take a look back at the interface we want to consume. You know, do I want to have, this method right here? Do I want to have this split into a different object? Do I want to consume this in a different way? Like we talk about, like those of us who are really like big OO geeks, right? We talk sometimes about like, hey, it makes it easy to decouple this. But how many of those people who are actually looking and consuming these tools have actually ever seen what a decoupled interface looks like? You know, we say, oh, go figure it out, work through it, and so on. Perhaps we would have better traction, like understanding and pitching the value of ORMs if we were to start with, this is, you know, the interface that we like to consume. It has these advantages. It looks really, really good. And then these tools help us move towards that. And this tool has this advantage. That tool has that advantage. And we can talk about ideally, you know, what is this and what is that like? And I think that an ORM compared to a DBAL library or something like that is already inherently much, much closer to the desired interface or reduces that level of translation than something like pure database access will allow. Let me put it this way. If you're using a library like that, you're already going to build your desired interface on top of it just to keep your life sane. This is something somebody's already done to help get you part of the way.
The naming actually gives it already away. One is a data abstraction layer, a DAL, So you're dealing with the actual data, whereas the other one is an object relational mapper. So the idea is that you're dealing with objects. So you focus more on the interfaces instead of focusing on the data structure. Now, data structures are important, but the business value is the first most important thing. And the business value comes usually really quickly down to how you design your objects rather than the data structure itself. The data structure is more of a tool, whereas you want to actually code it. You want to get the business. That's the point.
I think it depends a little bit on the type of application. Like, there are some applications which are for like data warehousing, or just they have simple CRUD operations. And hey, that's really good and useful for things sometimes. And in those cases, maybe the access layer is just all you need, right? La 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 la. But for many other types of applications, especially ones that are more complex, the business is less interested in data and more interested in behavior. And when I say behavior, I mean things like, I want to turn this data into this report. I want to turn this into that. I want it to calculate this and email it to people. Those are the behaviors that we're interested in. Databases are really, really awesome. They're amazing at data retrieval. They're the best tools we have for that kind of thing, I think, in modern day work. But they're not very good at encapsulating behavior. Like, if I've seen a couple applications, like old Oracle things, for example, that do emails to people, there is a reason we moved away from that stuff. It's really, really difficult, but it depends a little bit, I think, on what type of application you have. The more behavior you have, then the more objects you want, and typically.
Absolutely. Counting the number of sent emails doesn't need any kind of expression. You just use the SQL layer or the database anyway.
I think that's a really good point, too. Like, a lot of people see an ORM as an all or nothing. Like, if you use a database access layer, then it should be an all or nothing, because it's meant to be an architectural bottleneck to where you talk to your database, so that you can exchange it, so that you can test it, you can log it, et cetera. But an ORM is, I think, fundamentally different. It's a detachable abstraction. And we talk about leaky abstractions, but I don't think we have a word for detachable abstractions. It's like the hood on your car. It's meant to be closed most of the time. It makes the car better. It makes it more aerodynamic. But occasionally, you need to change the oil. You want to tweak something that's more low level. You know, you don't have to weld open your car, refactor your car. There's a button. You push it. It comes open. And then you can reach into the innards of the car yourself and do whatever it is you want to do. And that's the same way with an ORM. An ORM that controls all access to your database is a bad ORM. But one that lets you have like 80% that easy mapping code that you're after, but then still reach into the database and run raw queries and hydrate them, hopefully in a really easy fashion, for that remaining 20%, you know, that's a tool that I want to work with.
I like the car hood analogy. That really helps to think about the way that this abstraction is meant to be used. I'm curious about how you guys implement ORMs in your projects, because typically what I'll have is an abstraction layer for the ORM. I think a lot of people would call it a repository, but basically I would have like, if I'm making an app about events and it's all about start and end times and locations, I might have an events repository that says get events by radius, or a method that has get event by name, or something like that. And in those methods, I'd be interacting with the ORM, but pretty much not very many other places in my code base would I be actually directly working with an ORM other than within those repository classes. Is that kind of how you guys structure your all's apps, or do you see your ORM rearing its head in other places in your apps?
I'm going to be honest with you. In kind of like the Laravel community, I started talking a lot about repositories, and I wrote an article on repositories that I still get a lot of traffic to. That doesn't mean that I'm going to be using repositories all the time. I actually use, for example, Laravel and Eloquent, and I use those tools to build some applications, and then I use Doctrine for some other applications, and now I'm working on an application where it just doesn't matter. I can flip a coin and pick a tool, and it doesn't make any difference. So I think where repositories really help is if you want to have a place to put the behavior to query, or if you want to have the opportunity to have special behavior on storage or something like this, it's really nice. For example, I like to design my objects without thinking about persistence. I believe that for me, it's often easier and simpler and brings me more clarity to design my objects, make sure they work, everything's working well, and then slam persistence into them as kind of an afterthought, throw them into that repository and let the repository take care of it. And in that case, absolutely. But there are times when I want to build an application and I don't want to abstract everything out and I have a different set of trade-offs, and I'll just implement whatever I need to implement in, you know, it's a much thinner app with fewer layers, fewer abstractions, because I have different constraints and a different set of trade-offs have to be chosen.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. It's not really required to hide the tool all the time. There are applications that are supposed to be living for 10, 15 years, and you want to maintain them and work on them, and you really care about them. But then there are always these applications that are like, oh, I just want to mash something up, and it has to work. It may be tested, okay, but it may be super coupled with the tool. And that is fine, because sometimes you are just fine with that approach. For example, right now, I don't really abstract away everything in my application. In the current application that I'm working on, I'm not even using an ORM. I'm using something similar, though. And the fact that how it saves and loads stuff is very, very explicit in the application, because I want it to scream out how that works. In applications that are supposed to be very long term, then I have actually these repositories that abstract the saving and loading, and then I have even single function classes. So it's just that is just because PHP doesn't have auto-loading for functions, by the way. So you have just a class that has a single method, and I call it like users without a subscription report, okay, or get all users that don't have a subscription, depending on whether you prefer the noun or the verb approach. So you really have single tiny classes, and then there you can decide whether to use the ORM, whether to use, Elasticsearch, because you save the optimized result to Elasticsearch. You may use a raw SQL query. The important thing is that the output of that one is consistent with how your system works. You need to work with homogeneous data. And then, of course, there will be some hidden coupling with the ORM, but you keep it slow, but really only when it's a very long-running project that you need to really care about.
I'd say that pretty much nails it for me. I agree about the differences and trade-offs about picking for what makes sense in the application. I think a really good litmus test is how happy am I with the interface of this project? Do I want to accept it into the core of my application, if that's even worth considering because the application is so small or self-evident? And, if the project was like, decoupled tomorrow or decommissioned or anything like that, would I want to maintain it for a little while longer until I could get a migration strategy? If you feel okay with that, go for it. And if it's a project that has a half-life of, a week to 3, 4, 5, 6 months, knock it out there and get it done. There's no point in putting those abstractions in place. If it goes on beyond that, or you have to do a handoff or something, it's a different set of trade-offs. But that's all that really matters in engineering, trade-offs.
Yeah. DRM is a big trade-off itself. Itself is not an object-oriented tool either. It's a translation tool. You can think of it as moving data from here to there. It's doing a very dirty job, as we were saying initially. So it is indeed a trade-off in its own. You get advantages, you get disadvantages. It's suited for some projects, for some others, it's just poison. So.
And I think a big part of it is what you feel comfortable with. For example, if you come from a background where you're really, really happy with tool A and you know how to knock tool A like just out like that, then use tool A for your quick and dirty projects. If you feel like, hey, this might be a lightweight, more tool, but I'm comfortable with where I'm at, for those less important projects, I think it's more important to pick tooling that you're familiar with. Everybody starts up like a side project because they can use all kinds of crazy tooling that they just want to experiment with. And those projects inevitably fail because you're knocking out your side project and you're learning a new set of tooling. So for that, use whatever has the lowest barrier to entry for you. And I think that's as important as, is this tool heavy? Is this tool light? Because the difference between heavy and light anyways often depends on particular use cases or circumstances. But I think like really what matters here is how comfortable is the tool to you, how much typing do you have to deal with, and what's the lifetime of the project. But we're a little bit off topic now.
When you say less versus more important, can I insinuate that what you mean is with a less important project, you seem to say that the tools that are more familiar to you might be quite the way to go. But with a more important project, maybe you are more likely to really buckle down, scan a wide variety of tools and try to find something that maybe you aren't incredibly familiar with, but then you must become familiar with. Is that what you're saying?
I'm hesitant, like I chose my words poorly. I'm hesitant to say that any project is more or less important. Like within an organization it might be, but to an average client, if you're in doing consulting work or agency work, then every project's important, right? But I would say for projects that have a shorter lifetime that require less maintenance, then I'd be more inclined to just take a tool that's easy and off the shelf and that I know. For a project that is going to live for a longer period of time, then I'm probably going to look for tooling that is maybe a better fit for it. Also, longer period of time usually means that there's a higher budget. And with higher budget comes the ability to research something that will perhaps have a higher introduction cost. You need to learn the tool, but a lower maintenance cost. Longer lived projects, you really want to optimize for that long tail maintenance stuff. But for people who are interested in that stuff, then go watch Constantine's talk at this year's LayerCon, which I thought was a really good talk about the trade-offs of introduction costs versus maintenance costs versus cost of ownership, et cetera. But I think that's a good way to look at it, that different tooling will give you different types of introduction costs versus maintenance costs. And also the length of the project will give you more ability to optimize for one of those. But that's kind of like why I think development is so hard in general. It's a real life experiment where there's so many variables moving and changing and everything one time that you can't isolate a single thing. But, you know, that's just poor experimentation.
Well, some projects are just really straightforward. You just bang, bang, and you're done. It's perfect. I mean, some projects are really that simple. You just do it. You do it with the tool you're familiar with. You do it quick. You do it nice. You know how to deal with it. When you have to take a lot of decisions, then that's just our job. So you're taking all the architectural decisions that are required, and by architectural decisions, that includes also the tools that you're going to use. So. I mean, the more uncertainty you have, the better you have to take care of what tools you are going to use.
Well, I wanted to go back to something that Sean said, that he likes to design objects without thinking of persistence. And I think this really ties into kind of like, Ross, you kind of alluded it to it earlier. I didn't realize it's so obvious, but kind of been on a functional kick kind of lately, thinking of immutability and really thinking about how immutability in a program or in a code base can really bite us in the butt. And if you're unfamiliar with mutability and mutability, if you watch, we've gone over to several episodes in the past. So, and there's one even called immutability or functional programming in PHP. So definitely check out those episodes to get like kind of a background on this. But when I think about trying to make things as immutable as possible in my code base or as read-only as possible, I don't want to change these objects once I instantiate them. I almost want to do that with my database models. When I create a new user, I almost want to like instantiate that user and then not change it. I almost feel dirty by taking that model and then setting its name or changing its name and then saving it. Like, how do you guys deal with? Do you guys have that dirtiness in the back of your head, or are you able to kind of be like, oh, these are mutable objects. This is what database persistence is all about.
When it comes to me, I'm going to be honest. I'm thinking about mutability versus immutability, and it's a very case-by-case basis. I think that the mutability is going to be the clearest way to the way that something works and is easy to understand and is easy to work with. In a lot of situations, that's going to be number one. So if mutability brings a clarity to the code, if the code as a user interface for the software developer is easier to work with and allows you to get your job done better, then I say mutability is great and fine. Of course, it does have problems. You can make assumptions based on the state of the data at one moment, and then the data can change, and then the assumptions are possibly. This is the reason why immutable data in distributed systems is problematic. And one of the reasons why functional programming, for example, seems to be catching on so much lately. But I would be hesitant to try to, you know, say that immutability is fundamentally superior.
Well, it may be technically superior, but it's not practically superior all the time. That's the point. It's a trade-off again. So setting a username, I wouldn't call it such a username. That's the only difference from what you do. I would call it change username or something like that. And then encapsulate however the state is changed internally inside your objects. So you still expose the new username, but you don't know what happened beside it. So you can design it both in an immutable way or a mutable way that is up to the storage layer and to your requirements then. So you have some space to decide how you want to deal with it. But in general, the mutable approach is perfectly fine for 90% of the application. Nobody's going to design a new WhatsApp today, okay? We're not designing WhatsApp. We're building web applications that in most cases are used by 5 employees in a warehouse, okay? That is what actually happens most of the time. We are designing, we're thinking about scalability problems that are outside our scope or interest. Then there are obviously cases where scale is important, and then you start designing with immutability and with horizontal scaling and distributed systems, as Sean was saying. But in most cases, you just don't need that complexity in your head anyway.
I think a big part of it to me is about the building blocks that we bring to code. When we work in an OWL language, most of us learn the same way over the last 20 years or so. And we're used to a certain mindset, a certain way of building up these things. In some cases, especially in OO, that usually revolves around mutable. In some cases, it's immutable. And what I'm primarily interested in, what does the code communicate to the person consuming it? Does it violate principle of least surprise? Is it easy to use? Can I pass it around safely? Can I recreate it in place? I think there's all sorts of these concerns. And I think in an OO language, we're used to a certain set of building blocks. I think in a functional language, we're used to a different set of building blocks. In a logical programming language, there's a different set of building blocks. And I think that we use the building blocks that make the most sense. And those tastes and those what makes sense changes over time, and we should let them change over time. But that's I think, really what it comes down to. The choice between mutable or immutable is about which building blocks and which things do I have in my toolbelt that fit really, really well for the scenario. I don't know, honestly, beyond that. I mean, if we want to bring it back around to ORM specifically, I'm really curious, just throwing it out there to both of you, like, you know, does functional have a superior paradigm to ORM? Because it's such a defining feature of ORM. It was something that was meant to be kind of a temporary solution, but it stuck around. You know, we can't really seem to get ourselves out of it. I mean, there's a famous quote that ORM is the Vietnam of computer science. A bit crude, but somewhat true. You know, is there a way out of it? I mean, a lot of people are interested in event sourcing. Like, who, you know, raise your hand if you're working on an event sourcing application right now. You know, like everybody here raises their hand, basically.
My current app is not even using an ORM.
the person behind Sammy raised their hand. But there's all these different things. Like we have this long history of things when it comes to databases, for example, that were meant to be transition projects or transitory projects or used in limited scope, and they keep sticking around. They've become part of our default building block set. And I'm curious now if we're going to find in this next era a new set of building blocks, or are we going to keep using these things that we thought were temporary hacks, but just keep sticking around? So I'm curious, like maybe somebody out there has an idea about, you know, what does the next wave of that look like?
Well, these temporary hacks have been working for a lot of time. I mean, SQL databases have been working since the 70s so far. I realize now we have graph databases, which are much better. I think that's even on our roadmap for today. But in general, you have to think that we are abstracting the problem of storage on top of usually immutable data storage. So you could implement a functional ORM. It could work. You could create structs. It wouldn't be objects that are mutable. You could create structs, and then you could interact with them. But in order to make it fully functional, you would have an append-only data storage, which is indeed what we were talking about, event sourcing. On the other side, I'm going to take what Greg Young said at TDD Europe. Event sourcing and append-only data structures really make sense in some contexts only. You don't want the additional complexity of dealing with every problem as the history of humanity. Okay, you're not going to say, oh, it's pretty much like, who are you? Oh, yeah, 4.5 billion years ago, life started on this planet, and this happened, and that happened, and then finally I was born. You're not going to explain how you were born like that, okay? So it doesn't need to be that complicated every time. A trade-off is a trade-off. It's perfectly okay. It's not perfect, but we are here to build things that work first and that are perfect only when they work perfectly. And then the fact that they may be functionally perfect or whatever is just technical, if I may say, onanism. So, you know, that's an exaggeration.
I just have one thing to add to what Marco said. Marco, I think your aggregates might be too large.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, I have some big hard drives around here, so keeping my aggregates safe.
I do think it's interesting that we keep kind of pushing the complexity around a little bit. ORM was kind of meant to be maybe like a step forward in automating a lot of the grunt work, but not really eliminating the problem. Now a lot of people are really excited about event sourcing, but that comes with a whole other set of problems, in my opinion. Like the introduction cost is actually kind of low. It's really easy to understand all the components yourself, but the long-term maintenance costs and the long-term trade-offs of it, actually, I don't still think we fully understand. It's been around almost a decade, but we still kind of are figuring out, like, what is good design there? What are the trade-offs for that? What does the maintenance cost of it look like? As Marco said, there's a lot of history you have to take care of there. And again, it feels to me like kind of like this is a really, really good idea. I like it a lot, but it also feels like a transition period. It's leading up to something else. I don't know what. But, you know, what is that going to be? Is there any good solution for that long term? I'm beginning to doubt it. I think it's like I hate them all. I just hate some of them less than others.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been trying some of these new approaches, and they are hugely rewarding because you know why it's better or why it may be better. But on the other side, you are really, really scared by seeing how much code you get to write just to get to do the first baby steps. It's a lot of complexity that you introduce by adding these new alternate systems instead of using something old and boring that already works. So if you're writing something like 100,000 lines of code just to do something that you could do in a tenth of the code, then business is going to tell you to do the one that takes much less, unless there is an actual reason for doing the bigger one, the bigger code base. So, yeah, I mean, you have to always hate one or each, well, every approach, you have to hate it in some way. But indeed, I mean, the one that gets you to the job quicker is probably the best one anyway.
I think that the ORM itself is that kind of tool that keeps you from having to write as much code. And I'm not scared of how much code I have to write or how much, you know, whatever. I'm not really too scared of that because if I can keep the code easy to think about, right, easy to understand. But that's one thing I do worry about with things like event sourcing. How does that scale in a cognitive load capacity over time? That is one thing that makes me nervous, honestly, because having to type, you know, whatever I can type, you know, having to create new files, I can do that too. But having to be able to think myself out of a box that I've created, I'm a little bit scared of my own cleverness.
Plus, you created it. So the next person has to get in your box before he has to do anything with that.
That is kind of an interesting, nice thing about ORMs. Like, they're kind of off the shelf. They're kind of taken for granted. They've become boring technology, so it's easy to pass them on to the next person. Although that doesn't always make them the best fit. I do think it's really fun to try and chart, like, sort of how they scale. So, like, this is going to come across horribly in the podcast because you can't see my hands. But I think, like, to me, like, if you're talking about, like, this is complexity and this is time, that I think something like direct database access, like just out of experience, it kind of goes like this. Like, it's the simplest possible technology you can use. And it's really, really simple and easy to introduce. But over time, like, it just climbs almost vertically in complexity. Like, it just overwhelms the rest of the app. And then you get something to Active Record where the introduction cost is a little bit higher than that. And it, like, goes up pretty well, but it doesn't go to a vertical climb. It stays a little bit more linear over time. But it's, like, more features you add, then the complexity stays pretty much constant. And then I feel like when you move to stuff like Data Mapper, then the beginning complexity is a little bit higher, and then but it doesn't quite – it scales just under linearly over time to me. Like, it stays a little bit easier. You get some nasty peaks and stuff when you hit scaling issues and stuff, like, way over time, or you have to do, like ugly mapping hacks because no data mapper is perfect. But, you know, it's, like, not a steady climb. It's just peaks, and then it kind of normalizes. And then you've got event sourcing, which the starter complexity is really, really high, but it's coming down all the time. And it's pretty much constant. There's some nasty points. It's still climbing, but it's pretty much constant right now. But what's interesting to me is that these things change over time. So with Active Record, for example, the starting point with Active Record, and believe me, I was there, like, you know, early 2000s, and the Java programmers will laugh, but early 2000s, Active Record was a little bit harder to get into, but it was a big improvement over time, right? It was a big step up. And DataMapper, when that came out, that was like even bigger. That was a ton of code you had to write. It was awful. But over time, the DataMapper tooling has gotten better. And now I would argue that most DataMapper libraries are only slightly more complicated to use than an Active Record library. Just my opinion. But I would argue that event sourcing right now is actually really complicated to get into. It's the easiest concepts to understand, but getting it in a production app is pretty tricky. But again, the introduction cost is coming down over time. In the case of event sourcing, it's not just because the tooling has gotten better, but actually because the learning materials, which I think are the real bottleneck, are getting better and better all the time. And I hope to see them get better in the short-term future. But I think like it's important to remember like those are kind of like the rough trajectories of complexity for those tools, but they are constantly shifting. Active Record has gotten so much easier to use. DataMapper has gotten so much easier to use. Event sourcing is still a little bit harder, but it's about the only tool with almost a constant level of complexity over time, you know, or at least a constant climb.
Yeah, but how much of that complexity comes from the fact that as you build structure over time, you are married to that structure and your additional structure must be jacked onto the side. So if, you know, we're building all these models and they map to the database and then we have to continue to rely on that database mapping or change everything, change the whole application, the way it functions and the way everything maps. I mean, how much of that complexity is coming from that long-term growth?
I think like that's the art of it, right? It's like predicting where does the whole thing end. In the example of event sourcing, like I really love it for a long-lived application. It may be one of the best choices you can make for certain parts of your application or certain parts. But if your application ends at a point in time or the feature freeze comes in time, like it's not even really a factor of time. It's more like, as you say, like a rate of change, I guess. Then if it ends before you get that payback. Same with ORM, same with DataMapper, all of this, I think. But maybe I'm misunderstanding the point, because I think I am.
I think the question was mostly about coupling. If I understand it correctly, it's about like how much you got back there and how much you can move forward without breaking what you broke before. Is that what you were talking about, Sean? I maybe misunderstood that.
Yeah, it's something like that. For example, when you're dealing with, let's say, like a typical doctrine model. So you have this model and it's essentially just an object with maybe child entities or something. You're updating the state and then you're storing it back. And then the ORM knows how to write this to the database. And when you want to query this, the ORM knows how to bring it back and give you the object that you want. Of course, you start developing this stuff because you have to interact with it. You need to get this data. You need to get this data into this behavior. And you need to be able to store this data. But over time, for example, you need aggregations of this kind of data. You need different things that rely on what came before it. And all of a sudden, you're really kind of beholden. Like you have to use the same data structures for writing and for reads. And so you have this legacy of the more built up your app, the more models, the more data structure you have, the more you kind of get put into these situations where things get really complex. Like I see that a reader talked about a question, maybe I'm getting too far ahead of myself, but how do you deal with really complex queries or queries that rely on the native driver, like spatial data extensions in MySQL? Like anytime you have to do something special and you have to bring together different things, all of a sudden everything just explodes in complexity. And where with some technologies, you don't have to deal with that as much. But when you're just reading and writing to the same structure for your reads and your writes, it's much more complex. So, sorry.
I see where you're going with this. it's pretty clear. So, reading and writing to the same data structure is exactly where we all start. And it makes perfect sense for smaller projects. For bigger projects, actually, this problem that you're introducing there, that you're using the same data structure, and I'm going to stress same data structure, comes from the fact that we are talking about relational databases most of the time when we deal with ORMs. I think this is because of a dogmatic knowledge about how these relational databases should be used. There has been a big push for other approaches like CQS, CQRS, where you actually just push the data to your relational model. You use the relational model just as a kind of working set where you want to work with. We call it the write model. You interact with it, it does some things, whatever. And then the read part, you can design it as you want, because the data in the read side, you can design a custom query like the reader was asking. So you don't need to go through the same model. You make a separate model. But I think we are out of the scope of the ORM here. That is, again, it goes back to the initial argument where people are using the ORM both for reads and writes, but we are also using the ORM for everything. If we start separating and splitting out single pieces of the application, like custom repositories, custom report functions, we start to making optimized bits of our application, but we still keep them segregated and clean, then we don't have this problem. So I think that kind of solves it, but we are out of the scope of the ORM tool. So that is just because people tend to use the tool for everything. So that's where the complexity comes.
There's an interesting bit here too that we're talking about, you know, basically CQRS at this point, which is at this point in time, like really associated with event sourcing. But it doesn't actually need to be. I mean, I can have a CQRS application that, for example, uses one type of technology for write side, and then it uses database use for the other side. I would consider that like a relatively reasonable approach to how you build this. I've seen actual applications in the wild that write to a socket connection, look over a standard thing, and then they read from a database that's mirrored by a whole other upstream thing, you know, basically a set of objects. It was totally unintentional, but it was a CQRS application. Like, there's a lot of different things there. And on the one hand, like, the structures can bind us over time. They can trap us into a particular mindset, and I do think they make it harder to evolve and to continue adding new features. On the other hand, they can often provide a point of guidance at the same time, and they do prevent some of the other types of application. I mean, if we move everything, for example, away from structures to purely temporal modeling, for example, you get really, really good wins, really good fits for some types of things. But then you still have particular situations which are really nasty, like splitting aggregates or event streams or something. But another example would be something like graph models. Like, graph models and graph databases are a huge win for certain types of things. It's about, you know, putting that data in the right thing for itself. And that's kind of a, I think, a really, really key part of it, of being able to move your data from one type of storage or one type of backing to another that gives you a different set of trade-offs. I think that's probably the way of the future. I mean, like, at the end of the NoSQL wars, we had a lot of talk about polyglot persistence, and that's still kind of a pain in the rear to do today. But the more I look at it, the more I think, well, this is probably still the way of the future. It's just taken a little while to get there.
Polyglot persistence. I've never heard that before, but that, I like that. It's actually something I ran into when I was trying to implement Neo4j, the graph database, in one of my projects, and I was looking for ORMs that would fit the graph database. And when I started to realize that ORM, at least where it is right now, is kind of not really a great model to model graph relationships. When we're talking about graph theory and nodes and edges and things, I wasn't able to find an ORM model that fit that type of relationship. Have you guys ever tried to implement an ORM for a graph database?
Yeah. There is actually one which is for the RNDB ODM. RNDB database. RNDB is kind of the, I'm not sure about the statistics, but it should be the second one after Neo4j right now. The folks that actually work on RNDB itself helped us build an RNDB OGM in the Doctrine organization. So there is under the Doctrine namespace one. The point of that is still having some typing, so you can define which kind of relations you have, and they are fixed, whereas the actual graph database usually allows any kind of association from one object to the other. But that may depend on what limitations the storage engine defines. What is interesting is that graph databases are actually much closer to ORMs. In my opinion, ORMs are much closer to graph databases than to SQL databases. SQL databases are so far apart compared to what we are used to work with in the address space. In the address space, what you have is just objects referencing other objects by pointers, okay? That is exactly what happens inside a graph database. That is not what happens in an SQL database. In an SQL database, you have join columns and indexes, and when you join something, they hash the indexes together, and that's how you get the association. But it's not actual pointers, pointing at somebody else.
Exactly, and I think that's what I was running into, is that most of the ORMs that I was trying to implement were assuming there was a pivot table, were assuming there were like these foreign keys and all this stuff. And I was like, there are no pivot tables or foreign keys in a graph database, so yeah. This doesn't make any sense. So what was the ORM that you suggested using for a graph database?
It's called OrientDB ODM, and it works exactly like the ORM. It's kind of like the same stuff. But the associations that you create, they're not like part of the schema, because we're talking about kind of not well-formed objects. So you can kind of still get out of the rules of that, but it allows you to do that. What is interesting is that these storages are probably what the initial ORM implementers, the first people that built implementers, wanted. This is what graph databases are at. I wanted to get back at polyglot persistence for a second. Just so you know, everyone who has been building anything with Elasticsearch out there, I'm fairly sure that nobody saves data directly to Elasticsearch unless they have not read the news about its reliability. But I mean, everyone doing that, and that was something big in 2011, 2012, I think. I can't remember. Elasticsearch came out, and everyone was talking about, we need to do this in Elasticsearch. Everyone has to do everything in Elasticsearch at some point. That is exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about splitting reads and writes, by the way. Sorry, that was diversion there.
I think it's really cool too, but like maybe part of the reason people have problems with this type of thing is because ORM is the predominant model. That's sort of what they're used to looking at, but maybe it's not a good fit for all these other paradigms. Like I agree that graph database is like a really good fit, and you know they're probably a lot like the legendary object databases of yore that were supposed to fix everything and then disappeared. Meanwhile, we got the transitory solutions. But if you look at like event sourcing, for example, I'm not sure I would consider event sourcing ORM. Because there's nothing really relational about the storage on the write side, maybe on the read side, but not really. Maybe the same thing with the OGM. And it's funny to watch these different things like kind of use different paradigms. Like if you look at most of your Elasticsearch or Solr libraries, they follow kind of an active record model, whereas a lot of the other database libraries or the graph model stuff might follow a data mapper model. So maybe that's like sort of inherently saying something about the amount of behavior or the value of the data or the way you typically use the record or something. Like some of these are just trade-offs for different things.
So we're kind of running up close to that hour mark, and there's so much more in the notes, oh my gosh, that we haven't even started to talk about. But so I wanted to transition by going to Twitter. Lee Davis actually asked GandalPHP, also known as Okramis here in the tweet, what performance benefits are there, if any, of using an ORM, UOW, for example? I don't know what UOW is.
Work, yeah. Okay, so some ORMs have some advantages in performance if you have repeated queries. If you have a piece of logic that takes a user from the database, reads a field, compares it against something else, and then, I don't know, writes it back, only if something had to be changed, then this piece of logic, if you loop through it, it's going to execute 4 or 5 times the same query. If you have the same data coming from the database, then the ORM usually can build an in-memory data set that kind of hides this from you. On one side, it's a big advantage. You are avoiding a lot of input-output operations. But on the other side, the ORM is doing a lot of work to translate these objects back and forth. And then keeping them in memory. So you have some advantages, you have some disadvantages for some ORMs. So I wouldn't say that an ORM has clear advantages. It's just that in most cases, what happens is that you will have logic that is repeated, that is fetching the same record twice, and you are just by accident getting some performance improvements. That's what is happening. Okay, so you are getting that performance improvement by accident. But an ORM is an abstraction, so by default, like any abstraction, you will have a performance penalty. The fact that you're saving some input output is just a side effect that may bring some performance improvements, and that's it. You don't really get much performance from an ORM itself. You shouldn't even think of an ORM of it as a tool to improve performance. You're probably using it for the wrong use case scenario there. It's about abstraction, not performance.
And I feel like that could have tied into some of the other topics of discussion I wanted to talk about, whether for the advocates that were all about writing your own SQL. So maybe that's for another discussion, but I do want to at least end on what everybody thought this whole entire conversation was going to be about, which is Active Record versus Data Mapper, and maybe even kind of this event sourcing stuff we've been talking about. But I really did not want the episode to be just like this dogmatic debate between these two paradigms within the context of ORMs. So I don't think anybody on the panel is also kind of hoping for that either. But I know there are definitely different views on these patterns and how we should implement them and things like that. So for those who are unfamiliar with Active Record and Data Mapper in the context of ORMs, would any of you be able to kind of give like a TLDR on both of those? Sorry, it's loud around me.
Well, Marco, why don't you give the TLDR? I have a few ideas about
on
the
Data Mapper versus Active Record approach. I think Ross actually simplified it a lot, and he gave a very good overview there of the advantages and the disadvantages. So just the entry level is indeed simpler. You get for the simpler use cases, you get indeed quick access to your database. You get all this security stuff out of the way. You got your objects. You can already add some API on it. What happens on the negative side is that you will have some mix between record logic and object logic. So your objects are not purely just your objects. There are ways to segregate that by using interfaces and hiding all the persistence in repositories, but at that point, you're just repeating all the work. There was an interesting article, I think, on I think it was on SitePoint, about how to implement, for example, kind of like Data Mapper access with Eloquent, for example. So you can do it. It's just that if you want to get to that level, then you have a lot of logic on your side again. So you're just doing Data Mapper again. On the other side, Data Mapper has a lot of disadvantages because you get to start, get a really steep start. It's harder for you to get started. You have some magic involved, which might not be that transparent to first users of such a tool, but then you don't have to re-implement these concepts if you want the separation. So it's up to you. You need to know when you need the separation or not. In some cases, some more, I would say, religious people about separation of concerns and so on will say that mixing the two concerns is not approachable, but it needs to go down and drill down to what you need to build for your job. What you need to build right now is the important thing. It's not about how you build it. You may even build it with raw SQL all the way down, to be honest. Depends on what you want to do there.
So can you basically say that an Active Record object, so like an Active Record user that represents a user in our database, it knows how to save itself to the database. Whereas in the Data Mapper, you create a user entity, but you have to send that to like almost a service that knows how to save it to the database.
I went to the comparison instead of actually explaining what they were. Sorry about that. I realized it later. No, indeed, exactly. So in the Active Record model, you have a record object, and the record object has some understanding of the database, some of it, or has a reference to the database. So it knows how to deal with database problems, plus your problems. In the Data Mapper problem, you have a separate object, which is usually a repository, and you have objects that you push in back and forth from it. And they are, in theory, only your API.
So we could talk about a lot of things. For example, how Active Record could be perceived as modeling both a database record, a database row, as well as whatever you intended to model, and where you could use Data Mapper to have an object that models only specifically what you intended to model and then map the values to the data. We can talk about how there's an idiomatic element. So when we talk about idiom, we're talking about fundamentally the way something is expressed as a native speaker. In this case, we can talk about idiom in PHP. So PHP as a language, how does it express certain ideas? So if we write an object, and the purpose of the object is to model some concept, we can use features of the language to express things. For example, we have a constructor. You cannot create the object without first ensuring that the constructor, you can bail out of the constructor with an exception, for example, to express that these are fundamental necessities. In that way, you can use the idiom of the language itself to express to another developer what, you know, using the native language of the language. With Active Record, you also have idiom, but the idiom is not at a language level necessarily. It's more of a set of conventions. So there are fundamental differences there, but I'm also quite interested in the very concept of the debate of Active Record versus Data Mapper in the form of a dogmatic battle in which people choose a side and they pick their side and they dig in and they just fire shots over the middle at the other side. So where does this really come from? Does anyone have ideas of the fundamental reason that this shape even exists, where in our job, so much of what we do is to try to simply analyze, you know, what might be a good fit for the situation? How do we end up in a situation where one tool is the tool that we fight for?
Did you pick up the show notes?
Yeah. No, I think that this is the actual key point right there. The word is tool, right? Because in PHP, we're often talking about I'm arguing for or against a specific tool. When we talk about I'm arguing for or against Data Mapper, 9 times out of 10, people are arguing for or against Doctrine. When Doctrine is really like, sorry, Marco, but I love Doctrine to death, but I do think that there's room in the market for a lighter weight Data Mapper that's maybe doesn't have unit of work or Identity Mapper, care about those things quite as much as maybe allows you to write custom hydrators a bit more easily. And then maybe people would have a different approach on that. I've seen a couple of attempts. I haven't seen one that like strikes me as, you know, still having that same trade-off. And when we talk about Active Record, we're talking mostly about Eloquent, which is highly associated with Laravel users, which is a group that's come to occupy or like take up a different spot in the community, and has brought a lot of interesting stuff to the table there. What's interesting about it to me is that there's two main things that have come into play here. One is like I think a sense of history. About how these discussions have evolved in PHP, at least for me over the last 15 years, about like discussions come back, people are tired of having them, they come back again, they go back again, and so on and so forth. So like if you look at kind of a longer running history, I think many of the arguments make sense. I think the other part of which is, and this is going to be a bit brutal, and I'm not talking about a specific side on this, but just in general, people on all sides, I think sometimes have a vested interest in pushing a particular tool. And that's, I think, to create wedge issues. Just like in the States, you see it right now. There's an election in the U.S. and people are arguing heavily about gun rights, about religious freedoms, about abortion control, like all sorts of things, right? And those issues are far more serious than what we're dealing with right here. But many of these issues are exploited by politicians who are less interested in the particular sensitivities of the issue, but in order to create wedge issues to use a demographic to their advantage. With the increased monetization that comes in the developer market, people are using and exploiting wedge issues in order to segment people into markets so that they keep making money on them. Many of these people use that money for very, very good reasons. Many people want to do the best for these things, and these are arguments that they use. But separating developers into tribes based on issues which are fundamentally not important to the design and the quality of your application is benefiting somebody, but it is probably not benefiting the people who are being split into tribes. So that's not a popular viewpoint. It's not directed at any one community. I apologize if it offends anybody by comparing it to more serious issues, but this is my particular take on it. It is not an important issue, but it is being used to split people into thinking it's an important issue.
That is a very fair point of view, to be honest. I like the honesty there. No, to be honest, I even if we remove now if you may use the argument or not for other reasons, the argument itself, it's tribes like with any tool. Like all the event sourcing folks right now are pushing their flags and saying, oh, OR isn't bad. all the SQL people on the other side are doing the same, and they would probably they are even further away from what the event sourcing people are doing, for example. So I think it's actually just like with any topic, I like this approach better than this approach for this and that reason. And you get to a point where the discussion is just heated and then it gets noisy and so on and so forth. So it's just like any other discussion from my point of view about approaches. Approaches are not necessarily relevant to the aim, the final aim, but people like discussing them a lot.
I feel like fundamental to what we do is trying to understand situations that are outside of our area. I have, for the past 8 years or so, kind of ran my own small freelancy type thing where I work with a few other developers and we do applications. I could look into this world of mine and just dismiss everything that's not relevant to me. I could say, this is what's right. I could forget about all of, I mean, how is this not the most insanely diverse occupation? Like, we say software developer, like, it's a thing, right? But it's a million things. It's a tremendous amount of things. I mean, there's people who are involved specifically just designing mathematical models who are in this job. I mean, it's just crazy right now. This is not a specific thing, but yet nonetheless, we feel like we're comfortable saying something like, this is bad, and this is better, and here's why. Or, I'm like a rock star because I'm super successful and I have all these things going on for me. You should listen to me, this kind of stuff. I think it's kind of crazy that in our occupation, we aren't really kind of giving the respect to the people who seem to have a hesitant perspective, a hesitant way of calling judgment on things. Instead, we, I guess, can tend to rally around just loud people. And when you say event sourcing people or these kind of people or that kind of people, I don't really know what that means unless you're talking about the people who are really loud and they're really loud about one thing. And that's how they define their identity, apparently. I know a lot of people who are interested in event sourcing because it brings to them new perspectives. It allows them to grow in ways that they feel is, you know, compelling. But I don't honestly interact with a lot of people who make a hard stance on event sourcing is what you should do, or this is what you should do. I just don't think that's a very respectable position. I think I would rather work with people who aren't going to, you know, I mean, take sides, because whose side are you taking? Are you taking your side? Are you taking that person's side who's on the other side of the world or even right next to you doing a completely different job? If you're taking sides, then I don't even know what sides means now.
Yeah, no, we are fundamentally talking about the loud people. No, it's not. It's not really about just because you prefer an approach, you are segregated in your group, and that's it. Yeah, of course. I've been working in a government project recently, last year, and we actually had people taking sides on approaches, and that hindered us. It was a real big problem. And we had practical approaches that were perfectly fine and couldn't be taken because of loud people, I would say. So indeed, it isn't really useful to just be one loud person. You need to be more understanding about what is actually needed.
Yeah. I think that was also like a big part of like how we approach that discussion. Like nobody should wrap up their identity in a particular tool. I mean, a tool is it's a way to achieve something. It's transient. Wrap yourself up in what you're trying to do or what your message is or something like that. If you're trying to bring new perspectives to people, talk about bringing new perspectives. If you're talking about making things easier, make things easier. That's cool. And everybody has it. And don't be afraid to goof off and jostle people and have a good, like sports, you know, like it's fun when two teams compete and say, my team's going to kick your butt in the playoffs. No, my team's going to kick your butt. You know, it's good fun. When it turns into soccer riots and stuff like that, then, you know, that's not fun. And I think like that's really what Sean says is, I think, really hits home about it. You know, who are these people? Well, it's just people being loud, and maybe they're loud for different reasons and things like that. And we can question what those reasons are. But for the rest of us, if somebody says something that makes you feel bad because they're talking about a tool or something, they're probably a jerk. Maybe they don't mean to be a jerk, but they're probably being a jerk. you know, but don't let that get to you and don't push back on that or whatever. That's on them, not you.
One of the criticisms I've heard about Active Record is that it's hard to test. You've got this tight coupling of your models with the database functionality and all that stuff, and it's just hard to mock that. And also another criticism of Datamapper is that it sacrifices developer experience at the feet of the almighty architecture astronaut, that some things like that I've heard. So, like, is there any really valid merit to any of those kind of criticisms, and do those play a role into, like, which ones you guys personally choose, which projects you're using?
Well, you actually said it yourself. You have two approaches. You have either mixed concerns with the problems of mixed concerns or separation of concerns with the problems of separation of concerns. Mixed concerns cause some coupling. Separation of concerns causes usually increased cognitive load. You start having more things to deal with. So that's pretty much how it works. You can't really fix it.
I will say that, for example, with Active Record, it seems to me much more likely that it's going to be a behavior can kind of come out of the object and exist in the surrounding scopes of the object, simply because all of the fields tend to be publicly available. And of course, with discipline, this can be mitigated. And I think that that's one of the negatives of Active Record, for example, that you actually have to decide, now, are we going to be disciplined? And then you have to actually be disciplined about it. Where if you're writing your objects according to, you know, certain kinds of standards, then you don't have such ease to make those modifications. So I do think that there is also a difference with the way that you interact with these types of these objects. And how that affects the rest of the structure of your code. I think that it's kind of one of those, the medium is the message type things, where the fundamental expectations or the idiom itself of the type of mapper actually has a culture attached to it. So in Active Record, there's a pretty straightforward culture where you get this object, you call properties onto it, you're changing them, and then you call save. And that makes sense to me now. You can kind of see how you lose something fundamentally in this approach. You lose some of the explicit meaning that could go into what are these changes precisely. And if all of your code all over the place is making these kind of changes, some of them could be making changes for the same exact reason. Some of them may be making changes for an entirely different reason. And then it's up to the developer to reverse engineer this in their mind. Yeah, so I'm just going to stop talking now.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head. Like, it's all about at which level do you actually care about, I don't want to say interchange of your code, but at which level do you care about it? For example, let's say that I've got two objects in my system. One is some really vital piece of business logic, like, I don't know, a user, or a charge statement, or an invitation, something like that. I'm not going to exchange an invitation for something else. So that's probably a case where I might consider, you know, some sort of implementation that doesn't really want to change the invitation itself. So I'd probably use like a data map or an event store type of thing, because it doesn't really change the object. On the other hand, like, let's say that I am going to put some of that data into Elasticsearch. There's a good chance the Elasticsearch library I'm going to use takes kind of an Active Record approach. I don't actually care so much about the Active Record model. I care a lot about the fact that it's going to Active Record in the first place. So if I want to swap something, then I'm not going to swap the invitation. I'm going to swap the invitation persistence. If I'm going to swap something for Elasticsearch, I'm probably going to swap the entire Elasticsearch part. So the fact that the index, that the search index is in Elasticsearch, that's where my interface is going to break off and detach. The fact that there's some Elasticsearch records inside of that that are maybe coupled to Elasticsearch or whatever, I don't care, because that's not where I'm going to break off that part of my application if I ever needed to change it or test it or integrate it against something else.
This has been this is a good spot to kind of wrap things up, because conversation, and there's so much stuff that we haven't talked about, but I definitely feel like this is going to show up in future episodes. In fact, we're talking about graph databases later on this month, and I'm sure that'll tie into ways of interfacing with graph databases and ORMs and stuff like that. By the way, it looks like Sean, you're taking copious notes there. I don't know if that's what you're actually doing, but this is what it looks like. And It's really cool that you're doing that. Andrew Huggins has been helping me with getting show notes, actually rocking with every episode as a little transition there. He's created this repo on GitHub to like post Markdown notes because all the notes from on the phbroundtable.com are in Markdown. And so I haven't actually put a link to that on the website yet, but I'm adding that soon. The website's been kind of broken. I've been changing a lot of things and it's been broken. I haven't been able to push it to production yet. So I guess I'm sure you guys can relate to that. Hopefully I'm a little embarrassed. That's why it's been a little bit out of date, but the local, there's going to be some changes coming down the pipe in a minute. But so if you're interested in contributing to the show notes, I'll definitely give you credit on the show. And thanks Andrew for doing the show notes for the couple of episodes so far and getting that set up. And I do want to wrap this up finally with the developer shout out, which is the coolest segment ever because we recognize a developer in the world who is contributing a lot to the community and everything like that. And we recognize them with a $50 Amazon gift card and a special thank you note handwritten by me with my horrible handwriting. But the $50 Amazon gift card is provided by Laracast.com, and that is the Netflix for developers. And if you're trying to learn PHP or you're coming up, or if you'd like to learn new concepts like Vue.js, is like this new front-end JavaScript framework, and there's like episodes on Laracast about that. And it's not just Laravel stuff, it's like PHP stuff, testing, all different types of testing stuff. Really great screencast by Jeffrey Way. He's got that just familiar, lovely voice that you hear and it coos you to sleep. If you ever have trouble sleeping, just put on a Laracast episode and just learn while you're falling asleep. It's really great. So definitely check it out.
That's not how it works.
I heard it works. But for this episode, I asked the panel to nominate somebody who deserves the developer shout out, and we decided to elect Elliot Levin. I believe that's how you say his name. So Marco, why do we nominate Elliot for this episode?
Right, so I didn't interact with Elliot that much, but his library have been quite of an inspiration. So his main library is called PinQ. And it's pretty much LingQ for those who come from C#, but for PHP. So he takes closures and filtering logic for collections and translates it to SQL, to MongoDB queries, whatever you use, which is really interesting. It's really fitting the data mapper concerns. And it's really kind of opening a can of worms of what you can do with these collections and how to make them better, because that is a big problem right now in our specific work. So thank you, Elliot, for exploring that part of persistence and loading data and filtering data and so on and so forth. It's really useful for our job.
And really quick note, Link and apparently Pink, however you say it, these are more functional approaches to this problem. So earlier we were mentioning that. I just wanted to drop in and say that.
Excellent. All your immutability belonged to us. So thank you so much, Elliot, for this. I'm going to be sending you the $50 Amazon gift card from Laracast soon, and I'll be hitting you up on Twitter or something to get your snail mail address and get that to you. Let's go around and do some shameless plugs before we wrap it up. Marco, you got anything you want to promote?
To be honest, no. Just use the right tool, please. Don't use one tool because somebody told you to use it. Okay? That's
nice
it.
Nice advice. Excellent. All right, well, Ross, what about you? Do you have anything you'd like to promote?
I would like to promote the awesome things that my other friends are doing. Sean is doing some really cool stuff, which I hope he plugs in a moment. PHP women are awesome. I'd like to thank my mom, and thank you.
Your hat.
I was about to say, where's your hat? Oh, well,
there's actually, we have a talk recorded from the last Laracon where he talks all about his hat. Or the Laracon before last, actually. So a colleague of mine and I are making a video workshop on introducing event sourcing in PHP. So we're going to launch that. We're going to try to get that out by the end of February. So if you're interested in event sourcing and what you want to know, kind of everything from how every line, how it's coded to the theory behind it, we're going to really try hard to make that nice. But when it comes down to the battle between AR and DM, what I suggest is if you don't know how to use them, if you haven't used them, and if you don't like and dislike all of them, then you really maybe don't have room to have a loud opinion. So try to love and hate all of these things and kind of look for the balances.
Very nice advice. Well, our next episode will be the RFC show and tell episode, where we're talking about some RFC that are sitting in the pipe for PHP 7.1. Well, and another episode will be taking our idea from production part two, finally, after 6 months of part one ago, where we're taking this this dance app from just idea to actual production. We've been working on that recently, and it's kind of getting to the point where we need to have another episode. And we're having another, like I said earlier, a graph database discussion, bringing on some cool graph database nerds and talking about how graph databases could be maybe the next thing that we tinker around with in our next project. If you'd like to talk about some specific topic on PHP Roundtable, hit me up. Go to phproundtable.com. There's a form you can fill out and submit your idea, or just hit me up on Twitter. I'm Sammy K, or ping PHP Roundtable. And I'd like to thank Ross, Sean, and Marco for joining us in this roundtable discussion, and we'll see you guys in the next episode.
The PHP Roundtable is recorded live using Google Hangouts On Air. If you'd like to get more information about the live broadcasts, visit phproundtable.com. While you're on the site, join the mailing list to get notified about the next live episode. And hey, maybe even join the conversation at the roundtable. We'd love to hear what you have to say. The theme music is provided by BenSound at bensound.com. The PHP Roundtable logo was designed by Clint McManaman, and you can find him at mcmanaman.co. That's mcmanaman.co. Thanks for listening. I'm Sammy K. Powers, and I hope you'll join us for the next episode.